As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Hi, I'm Tom Butler.
And I'm Brendan Duffy.
You're listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast.
Join us on this journey of discovery across the world of the 007 movies as we take an encyclopedic look at cinema's greatest spy films.
We'll learn about the people who made them in front of the camera and behind, from Ken Adam to Max Zorin, with the occasional detour down a few rabbit holes. And we'll sometimes be joined by guests with unique insight into the world of Bond.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the James Bond brand, Eon, or the Fleming Estate. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we do get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us on podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the James Bond A to Z podcast. The 5th of October 2022 marks 60 years since Dr. No first premiered. So to celebrate 60 years of Bond, we'll be talking about the greatest Bond movie moments over three very special episodes, featuring more cameos than Casino Royale 1967. My name is Tom Butler, and joining me for the first part of our Bond movie moments series, he's the Michael to my Barbara, is Mr. Brendan Duffy.
Hello.
And if Brendan is my Michael G. Wilson, then he's our Harry Saltzman. It's Mr. Tom Wheatley making his triumphant return to the podcast.
Hello there.
Hello. Welcome back.
Yeah. Nice to be back.
So across these episodes, you'll hear from our lovely listeners, other podcasts, friends of the show, guests old and new, who've all chosen their own favourite Bond movie moments. And on this episode, we're focusing on the movies of Sean Connery and George Lazenby. So before we hear from our guests, what are your favourite moments from the Connery and Lazenby films that aren't mentioned by our guests? Sweetly, you first.
Well, the Connery ones are my favourite, so this was an easy one. My top pick for Connery moments, which is probably not one that a lot of people think of as one of the best moments, is the Goldfinger golf scene. Think that when it comes to Bond, there's loads of sequences that are great action. There's loads of sequences that are, you know, funny. I think this one really hits the nail on the head with who Bond is, because it's so subtle, so slow and simple, but it really shows you the relationship that Bond has with, or should have, with the enemies, where it's mind games, there's more to it than just simple action. And I think this whole sequence really sets the tone for some of the better later scenes across Bond, where they realise that it's not just an action hero. There's a lot more to it than that. There's a lot of depth to it. And there's many other sequences in Goldfinger that are like this, but I think that's the one that really, really sets the tone.
Yeah, it's a meeting of minds, isn't it, rather than a meeting of brawn, which I think really sets it apart. And yeah, I know you're a big fan of this moment, but there's humour to it, isn't there?
Yeah, it's almost like there's a constant undertone of danger, and you know that. But if anybody watched that scene without knowing the context of Bond, you just think it's two guys playing golf. But for the Bond fan, there's a lot more to it than that, and throughout the course of it, you start to see that Bond is a bit of a trickster. He's playing the game throughout it, and ultimately, he's just basically cheating on he's tricking Goldfinger on a golf shot. But really, that has repercussions throughout the whole film, which are actually a lot more important. And then you have the bit at the end where Oddjob crushes the golf ball, which is just pulling it right back to there's danger now. You're gonna, you know, there's a repercussion to this that he might get seriously injured because of his actions.
And a sprinkling of fantasy, right?
Because you got a little really bit of fantasy, yeah. It pulls it back out of the golf scene, yeah.
Brendan, how about you?
So I've gone for the fight at the gypsy camp in From Russia with Love.
Oh, go on.
I feel like it's like a mini Bond adventure in that scene. You get everything you get in a Bond film, but in that short scene, you've got the friendship, the ally of Kerim Bey, you know, and they work together to defeat the villains. And then Bond gets the girls at the end, both girls in this sense. But it is a microcosm of what Connery's Bond is all about, I think.
And underpinned by that terrific 007 Q from John Barry as well.
Which is probably my favourite of John Barry's work. It's a close, there's so much good work, but I think that really does help the scene, yeah.
Yeah. And it's chaos as well, that scene as well. He's like a source of, he's still calm, cool and debonair in absolute madness. So it sort of really sets the tone for him.
And let's not forget, when we talked about this episode as well, that this was all staged on a soundstage at Pinewood due to the illness of the actor playing Kerim Bey. And that in itself is sort of something to be celebrated, right? Just the level of production design in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Amazing work.
Incredible, incredible work. So for me, from the Connery era, I mean, I would say that the Connery films define Bond really for the rest of the 60 years, because it's always he set the template. It's the high that they've been chasing ever since. And so for me, I've sort of tried to avoid talking about some of the moments that came on later and really looked to see what happened in that very first film that set the template, set the bar. And the two moments I've chosen from Dr. No, you've got the gun barrel, which opens the movie, which has never been seen before in a movie. And then would be repeated in every single movie since, which is unusual, right? There aren't any other film series that have a visual motif, an obtuse one as well. It's quite an unusual motif that they have. The only other thing I could think of as a parallel would be the lit fuse on Mission Impossible.
Yeah, it's a smart move. It's almost like a designer idea as opposed to a filmmaker idea, where you're setting up the brand for the characters straight away. I think there have been films that have followed that have done something similar, but it's almost not always a parody to Bond, but you look at it and you go, oh, they're copying Bond. So it's a very clever stylistic thing to do, especially from the start. You can expect that coming in later, but straight away it's a smart move.
It's like a watermark, isn't it, almost, of the films that, like,
seal, you know, that's quality.
Exactly, that runs all.
And that's probably why it's not been, you know, it's been homaged, but films aren't doing it left, right and centre. You don't see that.
Well, it wouldn't work. If somebody else did it, you'd go, they're just copying Bond. That's
exactly
what they're doing. They can't.
Which makes it so special. It's so linked to Bond.
And also it sort of adds a serialized story element to Bond, right? It makes it say this is part of a continuing series of films. You know, having that, it's almost like the Coronation Street music and and the rooftops, the cobbles, that sort of stuff. It says this is a continuing drama, and this is the latest chapter in it. It's a really smart move, really, and that they struck upon it in the first movie is quite clever, really.
Well,
go on.
The other thing of it is that if somebody was to do it now, when you see it at the start of the recent Bond films, it's not that impressive. I mean, apart from Die Another Day, which is absolutely fantastic boom barrel sequence, but back then that it was actually quite technologically advanced doing that. So when people watched that, they probably went, wow, how the hell did they do this shot? So you're setting up the world and going, we're putting a lot of effort into this, it's gonna look amazing. So it's a really simple way of going, this is high budget, this is good.
Yeah, Maurice Binder is the man that takes credit for that one. So what I was going to say is that it's the fact that they brought it back for From Russia With Love. That was the smart move. Yeah, it was clever to create it, but then to bring it back for From Russia With Love then makes it a cornerstone. Right, let's move on to Mr. Lazenby then. He only made one movie, 1969's Honor, Majesty's Secret Service, but by many, including me, it's considered one of the best. So what do you take as the sort of iconic moments from Honor, Majesty's Secret Service?
Lazenby's quite hard because there are quite a lot of iconic things that he does, but I don't think they're particularly good. His Hilary Bray roles and stuff like that, I think is very memorable, but I don't see it as being iconic. I think for Lazenby, he was fantastic at action, and in that film, the directing and the sort of filming of the action sequence was absolutely fantastic. So for me, there's a couple of ski chase scenes in Honor, Majesty's Secret Service. I would say the first one is absolutely fantastic, and it just goes to show he is an action star, Lazenby. Like, it's really darkly lit, it's quite sinister, there's lots going on, but the skiing in it is absolutely fantastic. Like, the action sequences and the way that they've recorded it, just, it almost takes it up a notch from a lot of the previous films and says, this guy is an action star, this is just fantastic. If you watch that scene in on its own, if you showed it to somebody who didn't know Bond, it's a beautiful, beautifully set scene, and there's no comedy in it, it's just dark, really enthralling action, and it just looks fantastic.
And it's got the longest mountain fall in history, hasn't it? Where the guy falls off the mountain, and it just keeps on going and going and going. But yeah, this is the first time you see skiing in a Bond movie, so again, they really sort of set the bar high with that one. Brendan?
Yeah, a lot of action has been chosen, so I've gone for Bond in general being undercover as Hilary Bray.
Oh, right, okay.
You didn't like that. I just like, we need to remember, Bond is a spy, right? And more recently, we've seen him do spy stuff less and less. But in this one, going undercover as Hilary Bray, and he's having a good time doing it. I just think it shows another side of Bond that I'd like to see more of, actually, undercover Bond. Because it is a bit ridiculous that we know his favourite drink. You know, sometimes they even know his theme tune, if you're in the Moore era. So I think, I think it's enjoyable. It's good to watch.
I would have loved to see Daniel Craig do a Hilary Bray.
He could do the accent for sure.
Yeah.
You've sparked a thought for me as well. In terms of Lazenby's spycraft, there's the great moment in Humboldt's office where he has to infiltrate and use the photocopier to get all the documents as well, which I love. It's a terrific moment, again, in that movie, sort of an understated moment where Bond is actually doing some actual espionage work. I love that. But for me, the definitive Honor, Majesty's Secret Service moment is the ending. It's what the film builds up to, which is the death of Tracy Bond, just moments after he's married her. And the whole film is building up to the moment that they get married. And then to deliver that blow in the final moments is such a cruel twist of fate for Bond, but it's the fate that befalls all of his women, right? Or pretty much most of them, or a lot of them, let's say a majority of them. And having seen, I mean, I've always loved this movie from the first time I saw it, and but having seen it on the big screen a few times now as well, I find the moment, it's the only moment in all the films that leaves me feeling winded and emotional. And for that reason, I have to call it one of the greatest Bond movie moments ever. It has an emotional impact that the series has never, ever had before or since, I don't think. And we'll talk about one in probably in our third episode where they sort of try to repeat that. But yeah, for me...
I think they didn't try it before. I think that's the first time they tried to do that. So that's why it's so interesting. I mean, there's probably scenes where, you know, you can say it's meant to be a bit sad, but this is a tearjerker moment. And there's more to it than that, because it was the one and only time Lazenby, it's the last time you see Lazenby as well. So there's a lot more to it. I think since then they have tried to replicate it, but it's never had the sort of power that scene had, because they never built up a character the same way they'd built up and Tracy.
Yeah, I always find there's a stillness afterwards in the aftermath.
Mm.
It's quite, you know, haunting, really. Mm. You see that the one thing Bond has, he's finally, you know, given his heart to someone, crushed.
Well, that's great. I mean, obviously, look, this era doesn't end with Lazenby. It does continue with Connery coming back for Diamonds Are Forever. Sadly, none of our guests have mentioned a Diamonds Are Forever moment, but any honourable mentions?
Yeah, I think the fight in the lift.
Yeah.
I think with Peter Franks, that's really good. Stands
yeah,
out
I did,
for me.
I did look at that yeah. one. Yeah.
And it really, and then it sort of boosts his relationship with Tiffany. It's Tiffany Case, isn't it?
It's the only time in the film where Connery looks like he's into it. He's enjoying himself.
That's true. Yeah.
Not the moon buggy chase.
Nope. Absolutely not.
So, on this episode, you will hear from, in reverse order, Sean Longmore, Ian Sandwell, The Best Bits Podcast, Mark Salisbury, Melanie Williams, Kim Sherwood. But first, let's hear from Luella Chapman. Welcome back to the James Bond A to Z podcast, Dr. Luella Chapman, author of Fashioning James Bond and the upcoming BFI film classics on From Russia with Love. How are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you both?
Yeah, very good.
Very good. Obviously, we're celebrating 60 years of Bond. No better way to celebrate than to release a new book about Bond.
No, no, exactly.
We'll talk about that in a minute, I guess.
But first, and it's we appreciate this is a difficult sort of thing to get your head around, but we are asking you your greatest Bond movie moment of the last 60 years. So much to choose from.
There is, you know, I could have gone with the very first scene where we're introduced to cinematic James Bond in Dr. No, played by Sean Connery. I could have gone, given that I've written on fashion and costume, with Honey Rider emerging out of the sea in the most beautiful bikini, setting the standard for Bond girls throughout the last 60 years. I could have gone with Roger Moore's Bond, you know, parachuting with that wonderful Union Jack parachute in The Spy Who Loved Me. Or I could have even gone for Daniel Craig's introduction as Bond in the pre-title sequence of Casino Royale, where he obtains his AA status. And I think that's a wonderful scene. But because of my personal connection to this film, I've got to go with the moment that Grant first outwits Bond on the Orient Express, and then Bond gets the better of him in From Russia with Love. I just think that's such a fantastic moment in the Bond films, and it really has such a longevity across the last 60 years, both in terms of performance of Connery and Robert Shaw, but also just in terms of a wonderful balance of the psychological realism that Bond can offer, as well as the fight sequences and the spectacle of that. So I'm going to go with the Orient Express fight scene.
It's a great choice. It really is. I mean, it's a moment that we talk about a lot on the podcast as being one of those indelible, unsurmountable pinnacles of Bond, I think. Interesting that it's, you know, only from the second film. And you think, if it wasn't for the success of those early films, would we still be talking about them now, 60 years later? Probably not. But I think what I like about this, the moment that you've chosen, is it's got that sort of what's the word? It's like it's the travel element, I think. So it's got that sort of exoticism. You know, there's something exotic about traveling. We don't really have it so much nowadays, but in the 60s, I imagine it was probably quite quite evocative. And the idea of being on the Orient Express in Istanbul or whatever is just amazing. Obviously, they were just filming it in the backlot of Pinewood, but I think it adds some another element, doesn't it? It's not the 1251 to King's Cross. It's something else. It's something a bit special.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really encapsulates something that the Bond films can do if they choose to do it, which is the psychological realist area of the spy thriller. You know, the build up to that scene, you know, where you watch, you know, Grant track Bond, you know, while Bond's wandering along the platform, you've then got Grant tracking him down through the Orient Express, this haunting menace, you know, this build up. You know, there's the scene in the dining car, of course, where Grant drugs Tatiana. Bond clocks that, and the references to old man and, you know, and things, and obviously the Chianti and fish moment. But you've got this massive, you know, very slow and steady build up to this moment, you know, where Bond effectively meets his physical match. You know, this isn't Jaws versus Roger Moore's Bond on a train. This is, you know, they're very equally matched physically and psychologically as well. And you've got this really interesting dark mirror image of Bond. You know, and it's not played for laughs. You know, there are humorous moments in their scene together. But I mean, I was rewatching it earlier, and even when the smoke comes out of the attaché briefcase that Bond's kind of manipulated Grant into opening, it's still not a foregone conclusion that Bond's actually going to win this fight. And the reason I really chose this, and I'm assuming maybe other people have chosen their moments for a similar reason, is because it's quite personal in terms of my own viewing of the Bond films. Because when I first viewed this film, the first film I saw was Dr. No. The second film a week later, I was about 7 years of age, I watched From Russia With Love. And what my dad didn't tell me when I watched this film, that there were other later Bond films, and I hadn't read the novels, so I didn't know that Bond was going to get out of this moment alive. And for me, the suspense and the tension of watching the scene, I really thought that Bond on his knees was not going to get out of it. And so for me, I really experienced the suspense and the tension of that scene as presumably the filmmakers hoped for, you know, first-time Bond viewers at the time, even though I was watching it way later than the film was released. So, you know, it's a personal connection, I think, to that moment as well, is why I chose it.
Yeah, so it's just great. It's something that, even when I watch it now, the peril is still there for me. And we've talked about this in previous episodes, where it's one of those scenes you just can't take your eyes off of it. It's just, it ramps up, and it's to the point where you're thinking, Bond can't get out of this. He has met his match, like you said. Yeah, it's incredible.
I was just going to say, interesting as well. I know we've talked about this before, but how Robert Shaw was someone that had been considered for Bond at one stage as well. So the idea that he was going to go toe-to-toe with Sean Connery, I think they knew each other as well, I think. Meant that you're right, it was a physical match. And I think you remember, was it that he did training with like Turkish wrestlers while he was on set to get himself in shape for it? So Robert Shaw is a really imposing presence, although I think in real life he was shorter than Sean Connery. And so they had to do some bit of trickery. But another thing I like about it as well is at the end of the fight, Bond is on his knees. He really struggles to regain his composure. And that's something we don't really see again in Bond until, you know, Timothy Dalton comes in and you see Bond on the back foot. But yeah, I love Robert Shaw in this film. He is fantastic.
He is, and it's a great example, I think, just thinking more broadly about the film, where you have two I know they're technically henchmen, henchwomen, but you have two Bond villains that actually almost get equal billing. You know, they both get their moment with Bond, you know, the other being Razor Clegg, of course. But both are very different, and the reactions that Bond has to both is fascinating in this film. You know, and going back to what you were saying about Robert Shaw, I think it's in Diane Colento's biography, isn't it, about how, you know, off of the set, you know, Robert Shaw's very competitive, and he and Sean Connery have this running race, don't they, and things like that. And I think it's Sean Connery that wins, you know. But yes, they did, you know each other, you know, British 60s actors all, you know, working together. And it's really interesting to watch. And I'm not quite sure this is rather, you know, possibly controversial, contentious argument, but I'm not sure really since then we've had quite the same equals matching in terms of Bonds and adversaries, you know, because I think they are so physically well matched, but also psychologically well matched as well, you know. And a good example of this is during the fight, after the smoke's come out of the taxi briefcase and they're wrestling around in a very, you know, tiny compartment, very cleverly blue lit, you know, and this sense of claustrophobia. You know, they're both trying to use the gadgets they've been assigned by their organisations. So you've got Grant, you know, garrotting or attempting to garrot Bond, and Bond scrabbling around to get into that attaché briefcase side so he can get the dagger out of it. And you've got this really interesting equal balance going on. You just don't know who's going to win the fight, you know, unless you'd, of course, already read the novel. You know, and also I think the other great thing about that scene, because of the psychological kind of realism spy thriller that you're really getting, is that, you know, you get the big reveal of the plot to Bond that's not humorous or jokey, like you do in Goldfinger, you know, when he's looking through the little kind of periscope thing and watching the model and Goldfinger's talking to gangsters and stuff, you know. And as great as that scene is too, you know, this is actually much more real, you know, where it's like, oh yes, I can give you some time to tell you exactly what, you know, Spectre's plot is and how the girl Tatiana's not involved in it. You know, and you've got this interesting, very 60s spy thriller moment, you know, oh, you know, will you take money? Okay, no. Will you take cigarettes? Okay, will you take money and cigarettes combined? And there's this really interesting, you know, development in this argument, you know. So, yeah, I think it's just fantastic.
Luella, what would you say is the secret to the longevity of Bond? How has this series survived for 60 years?
Oh, now you put me on the spot. I mean, I suppose the rather, you know, dour answer might be money, investment in a franchise. I think, you know, it is hugely popular. You know, we do have to recognise this, regardless of what critics think, regardless of what academic scholars think, regardless of what fans think. You know, people go along to watch a Bond film to enjoy it. They want to go and sit in the cinema and have a bit of, not necessarily escapism, but they want spectacle. They want the stunts. They want also now, I mean, speaking now, they want something that they're comfortable with watching. You know what you're going to get with a Bond film, don't you? You know. But I think with Bond films, the longevity is really because they know how to adapt to make films reflecting the time we live in, you know. So, you know, we've said with Russia, and also with Connery's films since the 60s, they're made in a time of a particular period, you know, the same with Roger Moore's films, you know. I mean, you might argue that the costumes are particularly 70s that he wears, but, you know, they're made at a particular time, you know, political, social, cultural, you know, and they know how to move with those times. They recognise that. So, you know, with Craig, you know, more reflection of the kind of serious kind of born identity type things, you know, understanding you might need a narrative arc among films, whereas previously you could go on and you could send Bond on a mission, he comes back home. Oh, 2 years later, you can send Bond on a different mission, he comes back home, you know, he wins it. So you've got changes of that, and they've recognised that and they've adapted to the times, which I think really, you know, is how that series has worked. I mean, the most interesting thing for me is if you look back to the 60s, they can make Bond films every 2 years, and now they can make Bond films every 5 years, and, you know, ignoring COVID and things like that. So, you know, film production has changed over those times. And, you know, I mean, I think what's fantastic about it is it's a family franchise, both in terms of who can go and watch it, but also who is in charge of it as well. And I think that's particularly special and very unique. But what I particularly love about the films overall is they're just such an exemplar of British Labour talent. You know, these are British films, you know, and they've really developed and helped people's careers in terms of crew members in particular, as well as the cast, of course. But, you know, this, there is this wonderful sense of Bond and its Britishness and its connection with Britain. And I think that's really good.
Yeah, we see that as we go through the alphabet and all these amazing crew members, and what they've gone on to do since is remarkable. It really is a credit to British filmmaking.
So, Luella, for the 60th anniversary, we teased at the beginning, you've got a book coming out on From Russia With Love. So I feel like this segment has been a whole shameless plug for your book. But what can you tell us about your BFI film classics on From Russia With Love?
Okay, I honestly didn't choose the moment just because I've got a book coming out. You know, it's my favourite film. And, you know, as I said, the personal connection to watching it is why I chose that particular scene. But what I hope with my book I was able to do, and I did research it during COVID, which was a challenge, but I hope I'm able to reveal to not just general readers, but also fans of the franchise who know so much, by the way. They know way more than I do about Bond films. But I hope I'm able to introduce some tidbits and snippets from the archives, you know, as part of my research for this book. So I was able to look at Fleming's original manuscript that's available in the Lilly Library based at Bloomington, Indiana University, you know, where you actually get to see the original ending that Fleming envisaged, where Bond does not ambiguously potentially die at the end, but he actually takes Tatiana out for dinner. You know, I got to see papers from the John Cork papers based at the University of Southern California, where you get sort of the call sheets, you know, where Blofeld is actually named. He's not a question mark, but he is actually named in the call sheets, things like that. I was really lucky because I got to speak to Colin Sullivan, who's the nephew of Eileen Sullivan, who was the wardrobe mistress, who actually has a small walk-on part in From Russia With Love, as did many of the other cast and crew members' family, certainly for the 60s Bond films. But, of course, this continues throughout Bond's history, you know, making a very sort of British but family-fueled affair. You know, so I have various different snippets of archive materials that I've been able to put into this book, and I hope so, you know, so I hope that it's of value to people who are like yourselves really knowledgeable about the Bond films already, as well as people who are perhaps more general readers who just want to know a bit more about James Bond.
I can't wait to read it.
Yeah, well, if you want to review it, don't let me know.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Luella. Always a pleasure to hear your thoughts, and hopefully you enjoy the 60th anniversary of Bond just as much as we do.
I'm really looking forward to it, and I can't wait to celebrate it with you all.
Put your hands in your pockets. Keep them there.
Red wine with fish. Well, that should have told me something.
You may know the right wines. The other one on your knees. How does it feel, old man?
Kim, we're asking all of our guests at the moment about their favourite Bond movie moment for the 60th anniversary, and I wondered if we could put you on the spot.
One moment?
Yeah, I mean, it can be as big or as small as you like.
That's really hard. One moment. I don't know if this counts as the moment. I would say all of the train journey in From Russia With Love. That's quite a long moment. I love the building tension of that sequence. I love the dinner scene. I love the red wine with fish. I love the fight. I love how him on his knees, you have some desperate ease in that moment, but he doesn't give in. The lighting of the fight is just all so perfect. how he gets off the train and the code words and everything. I love all of that. So I think that whole train sequence would be my favourite moment.
That is a great choice. And it's just packed with, so like you say, so many amazing moments within itself.
Yeah, exactly.
It's one that we always refer back to as well, because it's sort of one of those Bond moments that is sort of a little bit different to how the series progresses into. It's not about scale. It's not about explosions. It's about its real spycraft.
Yes.
So there's real intimacy to it. And obviously you've got Red Grant as well, who's just one of the most terrifying.
So chilling. And, so good.
Yeah.
And I think you're completely right. That sequence is almost like a short story in and of itself. It does have that intimacy, and it's about escalating tension and suspense. And it really mirrors the book in that way. It takes that tension from the page, I think. And it's also so stylish and kind of calls on North by Northwest as well. You know, that sort of era of men in grey suits looking good on trains. Beautiful.
What do you think the secret to the longevity of 007 is?
Oh, good question. I think it's that he's a flexible icon, which sounds strange. You think about an icon like a religious image, you know, flattened and fixed. But there's the essential ingredients of Bond. So got to have a martini and a tuxedo and an Aston Martin and have a particular attitude. And that's Bond. And then we recognize, oh, that's Bond. But can also change. And so the character on screen has been able to adapt with time. And I think that capacity for change is baked into Fleming, going back to what I was saying earlier about how Bond changes from novel to novel. The Bond of the novels is very human and very vulnerable and does change and does become weathered by the job. And I think it's that capacity for change mixed with those essential ingredients that creates an adaptable icon that you can carry with you through the ages. Really one of our most evergreen heroes.
You won't be needing this, old man.
Welcome back to the James Bond A to Z podcast. Melanie Williams, thanks for joining us. Melanie, if you remember, is the Professor of Film and Television Studies at University of East Anglia. Welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
So the question that we've been asking our past guests, it's a difficult one. What is your greatest Bond movie moment of the last 60 years?
You're right, it is a really difficult question, and I've sort of oomed and ahed over different possibilities. But what I've decided to go for in the end is the death of Jill Masterson in Goldfinger, or rather the discovery of her body painted gold. And I suppose that the reason I went for this, I think Goldfinger is, you know, such a kind of powerful, memorable Bond film. It's got so many wonderful elements in it. So it was very high on my sort of personal league table of kind of memorable Bond films. But then I was thinking about that particular moment and how kind of eerie and strange and haunting this idea of death by asphyxiation of the skin through being painted gold. I mean, to the extent that, you know, lots of people think that can happen. So it seems to have, you know, this particular eerie, strange death seems to have had this odd kind of afterlife in popular culture. And the way that it's kind of simultaneously beautiful and horrible. And you know, you've been kind of gearing up to this from the theme song, you know, the idea of being touched by Goldfinger and this being the mark of death. So you're kind of primed for this moment, but at the same time, when it does happen, it's so kind of disquieting and strange, and as I say, really kind of memorable and eerie. And I think, you know, it's to do with the appearance of Shirley Eaton kind of prone on the bed, and she's kind of become like a statue or an object. Mm-hmm. but also that kind of musical motif that accompanies it as well, that kind of four note little kind of musical sting that makes this a kind of really unsettling moment. I mean, there are lots of kind of sadistic and weird deaths in Bond films, but there's something about this moment, I think, that really sticks with you as a viewer. And then the way that image is kind of replicated through the credits of the film, the posters for the film, this idea of a kind of female form that's kind of silhouetted or painted or has something projected onto it in some way. So it's a kind of big, powerful image. So that was the one I plumped for in the end, but there were many contenders for kind of a big Bond moment. But that one really kind of sticks with me, I think.
Yeah, I think it's a terrific moment that you've chosen. And I think one of the things, I mean, you mentioned the score and John Barry's score does amazing work to really unsettle you in that moment. But what I think is really effective about it is it all happens off screen, right? So it's not one of those deaths that that's gratuitously showcased, you know, like later on you've got Solo being crushed in the car and that happens very much right in front of your eyes. But this one, there's something very disquieting because at this point we don't really know much about Goldfinger. We're introduced to him, we're told he's a bit of a bad'un. And, you know, Bond seduces this woman in the way that he does. And she comes a cropper because of it, you know. And it happens under his nose, doesn't it? I think Odd Job knocks him out and then and then it all happens.
Yeah, it's very, the way that the scene works is very kind of dreamlike. So he kind of, you know, loses consciousness and then wakes up and finds this scene. And you know, that there's lots of kind of sadism in Bond films, but there's something about that combination of like this sort of aestheticism of choosing to kill somebody through that particular manner that's really kind of, there's something really kind of upsetting about it, I think. And, you know, given that there's so much talked about Bond films kind of objectifying women, and, you know, there's a lot of potential examples of that. This is literally turning a woman into an object and kind of killing her through doing that. It's quite a moment, I think. You know, I think it, because it's still relatively early within the Bond franchise, and you get the sense that by the time you get to Goldfinger, everything is kind of coalescing. And this is an important moment of certain ideas around, you know, how Bond works being crystallized around how it depicts women and how it depicts violence and sadism and all this kind of rich stew of like psychologically dense stuff around gender and loads of stuff like that. It's all in the mix there.
Yeah, it really is. And as often we're finding with these moments, it's the moment people are choosing moments that end up being echoed later in future films, most notably in Quantum of Solace, where poor Agent Strawberry Fields finds herself in a cinema predicament, but with oil.
But I mean, it doesn't, I mean, like it, when I saw Quantum of Solace, I sort of obviously recognised the gesture back to that earlier moment. But there's something about the sort of the gold paint that's, you know, that compared to the black oil. I suppose they're both turning women into sort of silhouettes in a way, which of course is what happens in the Bond credit sequences famously, you know, that they're kind of, their individual features are kind of obliterated by being turned into kind of silhouettes instead. So, and that happens literally by the way that those women are killed in those films. I dare say some, you know, critic with a real kind of psychoanalytic bent would be able to do all kinds of interesting stuff with how those deaths are presented. But, you know, thinking about how I respond to them as a film viewer, I mean, certainly that first seeing Goldfinger on the TV, along with all the other Bond films, that there are kind of lots of weird, strange, compelling moments that stand out in all those films. But this one seems, you know, particularly resonant, I suppose.
I think as well with that scene, it gives you, you're able to start measuring up what Goldfinger is about and just what sort of where his character lies, I think.
Yeah, I mean, he's not just a bad egg, he's a kind of creepy villain. It's a rare way of doing away with somebody, you know. There's a real sense of a kind of deeply vengeful personality to kind of choose that method of assassination, you know, as so often is the case with Bond villains. You know, you never pick the simplest route to get rid of somebody. You kind of choose the most baroque possible punishment or way of, you know, bumping them off. And this is a lovely example of that. I mean, but you know, but I think I was reading as well, there's this kind of urban myth that Shirley Eaton was actually like, it did die as a result of being painted with gold paint, which, you know, it wasn't an urban myth that I'd come across myself, but it seems to have been something in circulation. I think because she didn't make an awful lot of films after Goldfinger, so there's this idea that she kind of disappears from public life. Why is that? Is she still trying to scrub the gold paint off her, or has something terrible happened to her as a result that's been hushed up? I didn't know about that, but it was interesting to see that kind of, yeah, urban myth circulating around the film. It suggests that it has this kind of, I don't know, fascination, you know, in the public imagination.
It's an indelible image, isn't it? I think she did later recreate it for a magazine shoot decades later. I think maybe around the 50th anniversary, but yeah, she's been a great ambassador for the series ever since, even though she had such a small role. But something I really like about this moment that you've chosen, because we've spoken to a few people already, and it illustrates a different side of Bond that maybe we haven't discussed with our other guests. They've often chosen spectacular moments, moments of, you know, stunts or excitement or, spectacle, whereas the moment you've chosen is a much more Fleming-esque moment, in that it highlights the real dread and peril underneath every single Bond movie. These are life and death situations that Bond and the people around him find themselves in. So I think it's a terrific moment to choose, and I'm glad it's one you picked.
Yeah, well, I had to go for something a bit creepy.
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly. But then, taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
What do you think is the secret to the longevity of the Bond films, Melanie? You've studied them yourself.
I mean, that's it's so difficult to say, because obviously if it were easy to identify the secret to a successful film franchise, you know, everybody would be we'll be replicating that. I think it kind of links back to what I was saying before about the sort of psychological richness of the material and the kind of depth and complexity and strangeness of a lot of that material.
Well, that's, yeah, thank you so much for your thoughts, Melanie. It's been a great pleasure to speak to you again. Here's to 60 years of James Bond, keeping us all busy.
Absolutely, yeah, here's to that.
Hello and welcome back to the James Bond A to Z podcast, Mr. Mark Salisbury. Thank you for coming back.
You're very welcome. Nice to be here again.
As you know, we're celebrating the 60 years of James Bond. What moment have you chosen as the greatest James Bond movie moment of the last 60 years and why?
Okay, so I would really like to do the whole of Goldfinger because it's my favourite Bond and it's, for me, it's my the perfect Bond. But I won't do the whole of Goldfinger. I will just do the car chase with the DB5, which I have this corgi toy here. Because I had it when I was a child and still have it because I'm a big child. I just love that. It was, for me, it was just kind of, I always loved Connery. He was my first Bond. I mean, I think the first, I was trying to remember, the first Bond film I saw on its initial release or new release was The Spy Who Loved Me. But I remember going to see these double bills of Connery Bonds with my dad. So there were, yeah, it was generally back on my birthday, he would take me to see Goldfinger and You Only Live Twice, or Diamonds Are Forever and Thunderball. And I was trying to work out if I saw these before I saw The Spy Who Loved Me, but I can't remember, it's a long time ago. So Connery was the man for me, and just that car, I wanted that car. It was so cool with the smoke and the ejector seat and the guns and, you know, the oil slick. I wanted to be James Bond, and that was just really, really exciting. And one of the great things when I was on the set of No Time to Die in Matera was getting to sit in one of the original hero cars. That was pretty spectacular. They said, do you want to sit in one? Of course I do. And so I sat in one of the, actually interviewed somebody sat in the driver's seat. And yeah, that was just a thrill. God, the thrill was just amazing. And I remember that I literally turned up in Matera in the morning and I'd got a very early flight. I arrived, they took me to set, I had lunch. And then so we're going to set now. And I was in a minivan and we were following the five DB5s along the road. They had a police escort and then the DB5s were being driven and I was just in the van looking at these cars. I think it was maybe it was the hero ones. And so we went to the set and they parked them up and all the photos you've seen of the three cars with Matera in the background. I was there that day and got to sit in one. Unfortunately, didn't have the ejector seat or six. So they have other cars there that did all that kind of cool stuff. But yeah, so it's Goldfinger. It is Goldfinger. It is the DB5 chase. Always wanted to be James Bond. Always wanted to drive that car. Can't afford one, but had a corgi toy. And I think there's been spectacular car chases afterwards. I mean, the one in Spectre in Rome, I think is amazing. And the one in Goldfinger, it may not be the greatest car chase in the history of the Bond movies. And I watched it again today, and it's a little bit slower than I remember, but it's still cool. And Connery was cool, and that car is cool. And so I would, if I had to choose a scene, it would probably be that one. So, you know, Shirley Eaton on the bed, the laser beam between the legs. I mean,
it's all iconic, isn't it?
It is. It's, yes. I mean, like, as a young boy, seeing that on the big screen, I was just blown away. So I would have to go for that.
Well, it's a great choice. You're among company here. I know Brendan and I are both of that movie. I think what's really important as well to sort of about that specific scene is obviously Goldfinger is the movie in the series where things become spy-fi, right? Things become a bit heightened. The gadgets start coming into play a bit more. And that scene just really typifies what makes the gadgetry of James Bond so exciting. It's when, you know, Q sets it all up. He sets up the punchlines. And then when the car comes into play, all the punchlines come into play. And that's just the beauty, I think, of that sequence. And also the important thing is it's a British car, which again just says so much about what makes Bond so exciting, particularly for Brits, but like just as a series in itself. So
now this one I'm particularly keen about. You see the gear lever here? Now if you take the top off, you'll find a little red button. Whatever you do, don't touch it.
No, why not?
Because you'll release this section of the roof and engage and fire the passenger ejector seat.
Ejector seat? You're joking.
I never joke about my work, 007.
But it's such an iconic piece of design. I mean, it was the one I sat in was from 64. And it looked cool in 64, and it looks cool in 2022. I mean, it's just one of those... Yeah, it's a piece of design that will never go out of fashion, and it's gorgeous and sexy, and I think the sequence is extraordinary. So, but the whole film, you know, you mentioned the spy stuff, but, you know, Fort Knox, Odd Job.
Yeah.
Pretty much every scene is iconic.
Yeah, the round of golf.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, Stokely Park. I'm right, it is Stokely Park.
Yeah, I think you're right, yeah.
Which is obviously the beginning of Layer Cake is Stokely Park as well.
Right. And Gert Fribe and the music, it all just comes together in that movie, doesn't it?
It does, it does. And it's funny, I was watching it again today, and I think that they must have shot some of it at Pinewood, because when they're driving through the sort of warehouses in the sequence, it does look a bit familiar.
Yeah, it is. It's Pinewood, yeah.
Yeah.
Because they've got Goldfinger Avenue now there, haven't they?
They have, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's a great choice, Mark. And like I said, you're amongst friends here because we're big fans of that movie, that sequence as well. But what do you think the secret is to the Bond's longevity? Why is it endured for 60 years?
Oh, gosh. I just think the films are hugely entertaining, and Bond as a character is, for me, I can only talk about it for me. I don't know why other people think it's great. I think it's great because James Bond is just kind of cool. And when I was a kid, I wanted to be James Bond. You know, he's a superhero as far as I'm concerned. You know, I think they've chosen well with the actors over the years. Yeah, for me, he's just cool.
Good enough reason as any.
Cool. Yes. So that's why it's endured for me. Yeah. And the car is cool. He's cool.
It's just cool. Well, thanks
for
joining.
It's not very deep.
No. Let's not get too deep. Thank you so much for joining us, Mark. Really appreciate it.
Hello, Tom and Brendan. It's Will and Kevin here from the Best Bits podcast. Thank you for including us in this 60th anniversary episode. Kevin, what is your favorite Bond moment or scene?
I mentioned this on our Best Bond Scene episode that we did.
Yeah.
But for me, Bond is just overflowing with great moments, but I went for one that I remember seeing in Leicester Square on the big screen, and it was electric, and it was the opening to Skyfall. And it's interesting in that it is an inciting incident of an opening. It's not sort of a day in the life where you get to see Bond on a prior mission. It's throwing you right into the plot. You're getting to see M, Moneypenny. It's something that you wouldn't find in any other type of action movie where you have a spy sort of doing this for Queen and Country, like where he's saying, "Yes, ma'am," in the middle of an action scene. And it's thrilling and rousing, and it goes into one of the best Bond songs of all time. And for me, that moment was really one of the all-time great cinema experiences for me. And I had to mention it again for this, the opening to Skyfall. I love it.
It's great. And my favorite moment or scene from all the James Bond franchise is actually not a big iconic moment, but something actually a much more quieter. And it comes from You Only Live Twice. And it's the scene where Bond and his sidekick are going down to the docks to look for a ship. But Bond gets cornered by some bad guys. And he shoots some of them, but he ends up escaping up onto the roof. And we have one of my favorite shots from the entire Bond franchise. And it's a helicopter shot of Bond being pursued by bad guys across the rooftops, and we've got that iconic John Barry score playing behind it, and it is beautiful. But I love it because it typifies the personality of Bond. He is cool under pressure, he is undaunted in his pursuit of taking down bad guys, and it's also Connery, it's also the cinematography, it's the score, it's the music, it's encapsulate the classiness and the fun and excitement of Bond, and I absolutely love that little moment. There's so many, there's so many.
Yeah, and to reiterate that, what I love about the personality of Bond is in Skyfall as well, when he leaps from one carriage to the next and he fixes his cufflinks, and I just remember the audience erupting applause when he did that, because no one else would do that. That's not any other action hero's thing, but Bond is so suave and sophisticated, and yeah, God, I want to go back and watch all the films again, though.
Yeah, yeah. It's a fun project every couple of years.
Well, there you go. Thanks, guys. And best of luck with the rest of the episode.
Cheers.
Hello, and welcome to the James Bond A to Z podcast. Movies editor of the UK's biggest TV and movies website, Digital Spy, Mr. Ian Sandwell. Hello.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Very well. We are celebrating 60 years of James Bond. I imagine you've seen a few in your professional line of work.
Many, yeah. But it goes way before my professional stuff. So I believe we were both there at the No Time to Die junket, which was a high point of my career. That's the only time I've interviewed them so far. So that's ticked off on the list, you know.
So in terms of your Bond moment, you've had a think. Was it hard to come to that conclusion? Have you got one?
It was absolutely hard to come to that conclusion, especially because it spanned so long, like 60 odd years as we're coming up to, yeah. Numerous films. And I had to make a decision whether I was going to go for my head, which is my analytical kind of review side, journalism side, or with my heart. And I figured that when it comes to films, it's all about your emotions, it's all about your connections. So I ended up going with my heart. And with the first Bond film I saw, which was You Only Live Twice, which, as we know, there are some issues with that film nowadays, to put it mildly, in terms of sexism that greets all the early Bond films, and also the very racist moment where Sean Connery pretends to be Japanese and gets made up in Japanese in a weird plastic surgery montage. But my point is that the moment specifically I'm picking is the Volcano Lair finale, because when I saw it, it would have been on, you know, when they used to be on ITV in the afternoon on a Saturday or a Sunday. My mum got me into watching it. So I would have been like 8 or 9, I reckon, at this time. And as an 8 or 9 year old, you're watching a secret lair inside a volcano with a piranha pit, with loads of ninjas coming down and attacking everyone. Like, I mean, it ticks every single box. And now when I look back on it, I know that objectively it's, you know, a bit naff, but there's still that heart and that I remember how it made me feel. And clearly it's made me a Bond fan, because 2 decades later, I'm still watching them and still writing about them.
You forgot to mention the monorail and the rocket ships, yeah, as well.
Of course. That's the thing. There's just so much in that sequence. There's, you know, there's also Bond getting rid of Hans, and he drops into the piranha pit and he's like, "Bon appetit." Like, it's got everything you want from a Bond film. that just, yeah, as a kid, even now, I'll be honest, even now, if I watched that in a new Bond film, I'd be all over it. Like, because why wouldn't you be?
Yeah, it's a scene that's been homaged many, many times as well, isn't it? So you're not alone in loving that moment.
No, yeah. And it came back most recently with No Time to Die. There's no doubt that Safin's Lair was heavily influenced by that. And that was influenced by the novel of You Only Live Twice, even though the film itself went far, far away from that. So yeah, it clearly influenced everyone. And it has got everything you think of when you think of a Bond film, you know, over the top lair, villain, despicable henchman that gets off before the villain, obviously, some kind of weird quirk of the villain. Like, it's just got everything. One-liners, girls, like, it's, yeah, just everything.
And the colour design as well, I think, is also quite memorable within that scene. You know, you've got all the henchmen in their brightly coloured, whatever they are, romper suits. No, the boiler suits, aren't they?
Yeah.
Juxtaposed with the grey-clad ninjas. And I know, Brendan, did you go see it recently when it was back at the cinema?
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember thinking it's an amazing set design by Ken Adam for the volcano lair. But actually also within that, they've choreographed some incredible action beats as well. And unlike, I think at this point, you know, what was it, the fifth or sixth James Bond film? It really raised the bar for what we expect in terms of the level of spectacle and action. And you're right. I think it has been not just lampooned by, you know, spoofs, you know, Austin Powers.
Austin Powers, it's absolutely Austin Powers, yeah.
Yeah. But then also Bond has repeated the same formula, most notably, I think, with Spy Love Me, for sure. Mm. Again, directed by Lewis Gilbert. But and then again, like you say, it just keeps echoing and echoing throughout the eras of Bond. Yeah, I think it's a great choice.
I feel like as well, like I'm sure some Bond fan listening will tell me off and say I'm wrong, but it feels like the first Bond film that actually went away from the novel. Like it was very much, it took the inspiration of the novel and the angle of it, but just went completely rogue and did its own thing, which is obviously what Bond has had to do in order to survive all this time. Like there was only so many Ian Fleming novels and they were very much of their time. Like you can't imagine. Casino Royale did the best job of it, of like the modern Bonds, but you just can't imagine them being adapted anymore. So it felt like it set the bar for so many things. And it was the first appearance of Blofeld as well. Like he'd been in two films, you hadn't seen him, and then all of a sudden it's like Donald Pleasance, and you don't get more Bond than Donald Pleasance spinning around on a chair with a cat. Like, I mean, that is Bond. Like, so there's so many things about it that objectively as a film, as I was saying, there are issues. But just in terms of pure Bondness, if that's a word, it's just the moment that I think of when I think of Bond.
Yeah, I think it's a great gateway Bond film as well for younger audiences. I know it's one of the ones I sort of really latched onto as a kid. And I think maybe growing up, I sort of distanced, came away from it a little bit. But when I saw it at the cinema for this 63 release, I just think it's a spectacular movie. It is from start to finish. Yeah, there's problems with it. But it gives you what you want from a Bond film, I think, which is humour, action, spectacle. I think it's very much feels of a place. And then on top of that, or the layer beneath is just the incredible craftsmanship at work on it. Have you seen the photos of Pinewood when they had the volcano lair set?
No, I haven't. No,
You have to check them out because it will blow your mind. They basically took the roof off one side, off the ceiling to create the volcano that they could all then rappel into. Yeah. And when you see it, it looks like, you know, like when you see the picture of Chernobyl and it's exploded. It looks a bit like that. It looks absolutely mind blowing. But that was such was their commitment. And obviously, it was coming after Thunderball, the highest grossing James Bond film of all time. Yeah. They really were ready to throw everything at it.
I think as well, though, like the main visual I remember from that finale, as well as the production design's incredible, but I just always remember that like Blofeld's whole thing of like swallowing up things, and you just see the really quite crappy practical thing of like swallowing all the spaceships. Like that's what I remember from it. That's the moment where I think of that thing, and I'm like, you've got all this craft, and then something that looks like really cheap, but that's part of the charm. Like, it works on every level.
Absolutely. We've been asking people, obviously celebrating 60 years of Bond, what do you think is the secret to the sort of the longevity of the series?
I think, you know, if you're going to ask me purely on a cynical level, it's that MGM know it's their one big franchise. So it's the one thing they can keep bringing back. Like, I was looking at the stats, and it's like, of MGM's top 20 highest grossing movies, Bond are 11 of them. Wow. And they're the first six until G.I. Joe Retaliation, of all films. That's the seventh highest grossing MGM film worldwide. So on a cynical level, it's because of that. They know they've got a winner because they keep coming back. And the Daniel Craig era has just lifted it to another level with the Skyfall first hitting the billion. But yeah, that's that side. But then also the heart of it is they're that classic kind of four quadrant film. Like, as you mentioned earlier, like, they're the film that everyone can see. And every single different audience member, doesn't matter when you get into it, you can get into it anytime you want. Whereas there are certain other franchises, say like a Star Wars or something, that it feels sometimes that if you don't get into that when you're a kid, you probably won't have the same connection or same emotion to it. But you could watch your first Bond film when you're 30 or when you're 50, and like, I feel you'd still get that buzz of, because they've got the formula so well now, but they refresh it as well at the same time. So it's that kind of angle to it, I feel. You always feel you know what you're going to get, but you also know you're going to get something a little bit different each Bond era specifically, but sometimes in between films, like with No Time to Die, I'm guessing none of us knew what was going to happen at the end of No Time to Die, and then just sat there at the press screening. I remember there was like four of us left waiting through the credits, because obviously Marvel makes people wait through the credits, and obviously the iconic James Bond Will Return comes up. And I can't remember who it was, but someone in the crowd was like, Willie! It's like that kind of stuff at the end. But there's always something like they're a community experience, and cinema is a community experience across levels, across family members, across friends. Like, you can watch any film and enjoy it, I feel.
Yeah, I think that's really well put. I think it's one of those where someone like yourself, Ian, you work within reporting on movies, but I find that sometimes there's only very few films that people then want to know about on a personal level. You know, they know you work with writing about movies or whatever, but it would be like, I don't know what an example would be, but like, oh, is there a new Mamma Mia coming out or something like that? But with James Bond, everyone you know is like, oh, what's going on with it? I'm going to go see it. When are you going to go see it? It really sort of crosses over.
Yeah, but also. I feel it's also, we found this No Time to Die, but it's a franchise that is respected enough, like, that, you know, when you see the latest Marvel film come out, you go on Twitter, you're going to see a spoiler, like, within a day, probably. James Bond, after No Time to Die, like, I was panicking about when I could write about what happened, because you just weren't seeing it anywhere on Twitter. Like, not even those kind of weird jokes that, like, out without context, that you sort of know straight away with context anyway what it is. But there's like this respect with Bond. There's like this old-fashioned British institution. Like, we're not going to spoil anything. We're going to make everything come out. Like, even with Skyfall, what happens, like M's death, like that didn't come out either. It's just, there's this just respect around Bond, and it's so long established that there'll always be excitement. You might not like each Bond. Like, obviously there are Bond fans who don't like Daniel Craig, as Bond. But they'll be there whenever the new Bond's announced, because it's a new era. It's a new start. So yeah, there will just always be that longevity of it, because people love to live the spy life as well.
That's true. Right, well, thank you very much for your thoughts, Ian. That's great. Pleasure to have you here. If people want to find you online, how can they get hold of you?
So on Twitter, I'm Ian_Sandwell. And then just on Digital Spy's website, I've got an author page, Ian Sandwell, of all my latest theories and whatnot about all the latest movies.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Hello and welcome to the James Bond A to Z podcast, Mr. Sean Longmore.
Hello.
Now, Sean, it's a great pleasure to have you on the podcast here talking about the 60th anniversary of James Bond. So what moment have you chosen as the most iconic, or your greatest moment from the last 6 years of James Bond?
Yes, my greatest. I think greatest is a little different to most iconic.
Yes,
I've kind of interpreted greatest as my favourite. So I've gone for the bit. It's a bit that always gives me goosebumps, and that's the ending battle of Piz Gloria in Honor Majesty's Secret Service, which I absolutely adore for a whole variety of reasons.
Well, why don't you give us some of those reasons, Sean?
Yes, well, it's the moment it sort of starts when you get Dinah Rigg and Telly Savalas playing off one another, and you kind of get that lovely sort of poetic build-up, and everything's just sort of so wonderfully shot. And then everything storms and descends into that big kind of battle chaos that was synonymous with Bond at the time. And for me, it's just the whole sequence is perfect. I mean, I love Honor Majesty's Secret Service anyway. It's my favourite movie, like favourite movie altogether, so I'm probably a little bit biased. But the whole thing every time, it's so beautifully shot. It almost feels like it's sort of choreographed in a way. And just so like wonderfully done, well acted. It's all set to I think it's the last inclusion of the original version of the James Bond theme. I think it's the last time we hear it in the whole franchise. So it kind of has, for me, it kind of has that sort of grand finale, sort of wrapping up of 1960s James Bond to it, all within one sequence. And then you get all the cool stuff, like you get the gorgeous shots of the helicopters coming over the horizon. There's all the flamethrower, there's some great stunts, there's even there's a cutaway shot of the cable car exploding, and it looks kind of like some really bad sort of spliced together rear projection bits. But I don't think I'd have it any other way, because it's so sort of like iconic of 60s filmmaking craft. And I just love it. And also you get as well, you kind of get both Bond and Tracy, Mrs. Bond, sort of presented as equals through the whole sequence. So she's taking down one of the goons and having a full-on kind of fist fight, which is the thing you kind of associate with Bond to have up until that point. So it's kind of, then the film is truly sort of presenting to you that she's truly worthy of being Mrs. James Bond. And you see her on an equal footing, and I love that. I could literally spout on about it for ages. There's all sorts. The disappearing helicopter, which again, it's a sort of, it shows Peter Hunt sort of splicing footage together in a way you wouldn't normally do for continuity, but because of his unique sort of filmmaking style that he brings to the movie as a whole, it kind of works. And there's lots of filmmaking techniques like that really work. There's the guy jumping out the helicopter getting lost in the snow. There's just lots of little things in there as well as the main stuff. With Lazenby sort of commanding his way through this wonderful action sequence when he's going across the curling rink.
What a moment.
And he kind of just feels really cool, doesn't he? And it's by that point, you kind of warm to Lazenby throughout the film, and that point, in my head, it kind of clicks that you're kind of going, okay, yeah, this guy's Bond, and it's a shame that didn't carry on a bit more. But yeah, that whole sequence, I just absolutely adore it.
Yeah, I mean, it's got a grand scale to it that cannot be denied. And it's interesting as well that this is the first time in the Bond series that we get the mountain snow sequences on a Majesty's Secret Service really, you know, plants its flag in the sand as being the definitive mountain sequence for Bond. And this sequence, in particular, is fantastic. I mean, you've mentioned so many different aspects there that we could pick apart. The first part you mentioned about the interplay between Telly Savalas and Dinah Rigg.
Yes.
It's just so beautifully done. And we get a Blofeld that is, he's potent, he's virile. He's my favourite version of Blofeld, I think.
Mm-hmm, same. He's so smooth and charming, yet he kind of oozes that sort of evil vibe as well. I think all of them are great, and I love the campness of Charles Gray. But there's something about Telly Savalas that he commands a room, and I think Dinah Rigg has that same quality as an actress. So when you put them together, that whole, it's kind of a really understated little bit of a sequence. But you really get the sense that you're watching two great actors sort of both playing to fight for the power in each shot and the scene.
You've got that exchange of poetry as well, which I always think is a beautiful moment that sort of sets this film apart from possibly other Bond films in its in its dialogue.
So Master of the World, My Dawn. It's an adapted piece of poetry. I don't think that is... I'm sure I've read somewhere that that's not the very original piece of poetry, which is, I think, is a wonderful Bond thing, is that the Peter Hunt or whoever, when they were choosing a piece for that they could sort of recite, maybe it came down to the actors, sort of adapted it and thought, well, we can play a little bit more with that. And it kind of, it's that lovely way of Bond taking something and adapting it into being something greater that I think is something the franchise as a whole. But yeah, it's beautiful and it's all set to that lovely orange sky when they go upstairs. It's beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, I always think with the orange sky and also matching with the orange jumpsuits, it's sort of a beautifully colourful movie, isn't it? I think we mentioned that it was sort of the end of the 60s, the culmination of the 60s, and I think this movie really encapsulates that. And incredible to think it's Peter Hunt's directorial debut.
Yeah. You can really tell he's much like John Glenn did when he started. He's learned a lot from editing Bond, and he's coming into Bond as a very sort of technical director. And it's something that's quite extraordinary, I think, as a sort of case study in filmmaking, because typically when you look at a director, it's often said you either get an actor director or you get a technical director. And an actor director is someone who very much focuses on actors and directing actors and casting really good people and believes the actors are going to carry what you see on screen. You get a technical director, which is someone that focuses on special effects and focuses on, say, a lot like Peter Hunt does with it, all the editing and sort of the visual sort of filmmaking techniques behind the camera. But what's really unique, I find, is that Peter Hunt somehow has managed to do both with Honor Majesty's Secret Service. Yeah. And he's got a wonderful cast that he wonderfully directs. And it's such a very technically complicated film that he really pulls off. And what you're saying, what you said about the colour also plays off what you also said about it being Bond's first planting the flag for snow sequences, because you've got all this wonderful colour set against white, which is something the Bond franchise hadn't done before. And it really does, like you say, help highlight it as something different.
And talking about, like, I know we said the greatest / most iconic, but this is a sequence that has, you know, has echoes through Hollywood afterwards as well. I mean, I'm thinking specifically of Inception, which Christopher Nolan acknowledged were that sequence in the mountains was directly, you know, inspired by this movie. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it tops what happens in Honor Majesty's Secret Service. It's just such a great culmination of story and set piece, I think.
Absolutely. I love Inception as a movie, but also that kind of, there's a real focus on action there. What the Majesty sequence, almost in a way, when you compare it to sort of like the big action at the end of You Only Live Twice and how they were following it, it always feels a little bit understated and a little bit more calm. It kind of feels like I'm watching a very choreographed dance. I could feel like I'm watching sort of ballet, where you've got sort of all the vehicles, the helicopters sweeping in, you can kind of follow the geography through Piz Gloria as Bond and all of Draco's sort of men sort of follow their way through. It feels very well technically put together, and every shot in there is sort of framed to feel like a painting. It's really just, it's gorgeous. You could take a freeze frame at any point in the sequence, and you'd have a beautiful sort of little picture, a beautiful desktop background kind of thing.
Yeah, and you mentioned it being like a dance or musical sequence, but and obviously John Barry's score does wonders.
That is the thing. It's I'm completely talking over you here. We get the last rendition, the last use of the original rendition of the James Bond theme, which is kind of chopped up and re-edited when you listen to it how it is in the edit process, they've clearly like divided it up to match what's happening on screen. And then you get John Barry coming in with that great bit of music that's got a real pace and energy to it as Bond's chasing Tell Us of Alice.
The stunt work obviously is exemplary in this. And I think what's come through with these greatest moments of Bond that we've done so far, is it's never just, you know, an acting scene. It's never just a stunt scene. It's the combination of all the things together that makes a great Bond movie moment, I think. And the stunt work in this is exemplary.
Oh, it's sublime. And there's a lot of things I think you can just sort of take for granted that were really difficult stunts, like the guys jumping out the helicopter and he disappears into the snow. That's really dangerous, but
yeah,
it's just such a small moment. And then there's a guy in a very small space with a flamethrower, again, firing at a man behind the camera. Like, it's something, again, really fucking dangerous. But it just all looks so easy and so well done, and it's so easy to get lost in it as a viewer, and I think that's part of the magic.
And worth mentioning as well that Piz Gloria itself was basically cobbled together by Eon for the movie on an existing structure, which in itself is a miracle of movie making.
Mm-hmm. And it's Piz Gloria is, like I said, there was something between greatest and most iconic, but Piz Gloria is actually really iconic in the Bond world. It's a really iconic image. I think it's something we all sort of recognise instantly as Bond fans. And maybe it's not quite as big and as outlandish as the volcano set from You Only Live Twice. But there's something in its simplicity. There's evil base on top of a mountain, and it looks like is it an octagon? Is it a dodecagon? I'm not sure, but it just looks so beautiful up there that it has become iconic.
And that really works. You can sort of feel that they're shooting that on location, which you wouldn't have got had they had to resort to building it on a soundstage. I know some of it is on a soundstage, but you really feel like they put the money on the screen when you see those landscapes. I think you've chosen an absolutely terrific moment, Sean. I'm thrilled you chose this. It's definitely one of my favourite Bond climaxes. I love the use of Chekhov's wall spikes, you know.
Yes. This. Oh, yeah. You see them through the whole film and you're like, you know.
You're just waiting for it, aren't you?
It's like, and they lead the build up, and then even getting the guy down the stairs, like he gets a ring on his head, and it's like you're just waiting. And of course, well, that is something as well that comes back to the music. That moment where the guard lands on the spike and it goes into his back is the exact moment they cut off the James Bond theme. You get that ding twang at the end, and it's so wonderful. It's brilliant.
Right. Well, thank you so much for choosing that moment, Sean. We're asking everyone as well, what do you think the secret is to the longevity of Bond? How has it survived for the last 60 years?
Oh, see, it's one hell of a question, this one. There's a lot of things you could say, I guess, in terms of him being a British icon and stuff. But I think you can break that down further, and particularly with the films. I think what's so wonderfully unique about Bond as a franchise and why it's managed to last so long is its ability to reinvent itself and its ability to sort of stay contemporary and be able to change. I think that's a really sort of something that is taken for granted that is really sort of focused on in Bond, is that every film is vastly different. Everyone feels like a new director or a new crew sort of coming to tackle it. It's constantly evolving, and it's not afraid to sort of take the era that it was made in and sort of showcase it really well. Like the 60s films, they feel very much like 60s spy films. I guess that's because they kind of influenced the craze. But then the 70s films, there's a lot of sort of reaction to what's going on, particularly in cinema. I'm sorry, excuse me a sec. And I think then that carries on through the 80s and the 90s. And it's sort of, it just, Bond has a great way, the films have a great way of keeping themselves relevant and current in a way that appeals to everybody. So you're not just making a Bond film that's going to appeal to James Bond fans. The generations of kids can watch these films back, and they don't feel like they've aged. Or at least they didn't when I was a kid and I started watching Bond and I saw Spy Who Loved Me on ITV. And you go back and watch it, and this, I don't feel like I'm watching an old movie. I don't feel like I'm watching my parents' movie. I feel like I'm watching something that really communicates to me. Even though Spy Who Loved Me is incredibly 70s. There's flares and everything.
Disco. And
yeah, it's so disco, isn't it? It's so disco. But it also, it doesn't feel like it's aged a day in many ways because of how thought through all the stunt sequences are, how well shot everything is, how sort of like how much effort's gone into building the sets and making them look not contemporary but also very contemporary. It's a very sort of hard job that everyone comes together, and that's the thing I guess with every Bond film is everyone comes together and works really hard. They work their socks off and it really comes across on screen. I don't think there's ever been a Bond film that you can watch and it feels like a lazy cash grab. No Bond film, possibly never say never again, but that's a whole different thing. None of them feel like they're just ticking boxes. None of them feel like, well, we've got to do this, now we've got to do this. They all feel different and unique, and every sequence is thought out, and getting between every sequence is thought out. They're also, I think, they're films that aren't so too heavily focused on script and story. And I know a lot of people will be thinking now, like, "Whoa, he's a madman! What's he saying?" But I think that's a good thing. I think it's great that everyone on the production team is talking. So Ken Adam as a production designer can come in and say, well, let's change this little bit of script because I can do something that looks cooler. And everyone works collaboratively. And I think that's what filmmaking should be. And that's why I think Bond sort of just continues to evolve and continues to last. It doesn't come down. It's not one man. It's not one writer. It's not even one producer. It's everybody sharing their knowledge and wanting to work really hard to create something that's going to speak to everybody, masses of people. Anybody can enjoy a Bond film. They don't sort of tunnel vision it in to being for one specific type of audience. I think that's brilliant. I think it should be celebrated. And we've got a huge change coming up now. And I think that absolutely should be embraced.
Yeah.
Moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've really put it beautifully there. It's about, you know, harmony, people working together. And I think at this stage, 60 years as a franchise, there is no other franchise that has had this success rate. I mean, you could say Star Trek, Doctor Who, but these are 25 blockbuster movies, each one of them a miracle in their own right.
Absolutely. And even when you look back at, if you do look back at other franchises, Star Trek, Doctor Who, Star Wars, even sort of like Batman, things like that, they've all kind of had periods where we collectively look back at them and go, oh, that wasn't so good. I don't think there's any point in the James Bond franchise where everyone would agree and look back and go, oh, that wasn't so good. Somebody loves every single piece of it. Even absolutely, there's a lot of people, there'll be people be screaming at me now going, well, Die Another Day was rubbish. But I love Die Another Day because as a kid, it really spoke to me. As a 7-year-old, it was brilliant.
There are bits to love about that movie, I think, and it has its important place in the franchise. So every single movie does, and I think that's also part of it as well. I mean, I'm a big fan of the Beatles, and I think a lot of the sort of the mystique and the prestige that exists around the Beatles is because of the story behind the Beatles. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the same for Bond as well, right? The story behind Bond is as interesting as the stories that they put on the big screen. And yeah, I hope they get another 60 years. I don't think I'll be around to see them all, but I'd hope to be.
Oh, you never know. You might be interviewing me again for the 120th.
Hundreds. I'll see you again. Yeah. God, that's a terrifying thought, isn't it? Well, thank you so much for joining us, Sean. How do people find you online if they want to see what you're up to?
Online, I'm at the moment I'm just on social media. Instagram, I'm at Sean Longmore. Twitter, I'm that tall ginger, I think. I'm on social media. I don't really know how to use it, but sometimes I post things. This is coming out during the anniversary, isn't it? So I will probably, hopefully, have done lots of lovely Bond stuff by then. So I'll have lots of lovely new Bond pictures for people to just look at and enjoy, and just to help celebrate with everybody. So yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for listening to me waffle on. I really appreciate it.
I've loved it. Thank you so much, Sean.
Thank you.
James Bond A to Z podcast is hosted and produced by Tom Butler and Brendan Duffy, with music by Tom Ingermels and artwork by Helene Dolly. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please like and subscribe and leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Get all the Masterforce outdoor power equipment you need to maintain your yard at Menards. Own the outdoors with Masterforce 80-volt power equipment, delivering all the power of gas without the maintenance. The entire 80-volt line is powered by brushless motors for ultimate performance and productivity. From lawnmowers to leaf blowers, string trimmers, and more, find everything you need to create the lawn of your dreams with Masterforce power equipment at Menards. Save big.